Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off by going through some of the headlines, and then we have an in-depth conversation about organized labor in Fresno, both its history and the role that it's playing today in our local economy. And then we'll close by talking about some of our favorite election night memories. Before we get into this podcast, I just wanted to put out a little reminder. If you're loving this show, if you enjoy our content, it helps you understand local politics better, consider giving us a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Donnie, what are some of the headlines this week?
Yeah, there was a lot going on. There was a press conference this week on Wednesday where city leaders and state leaders broke ground on a $22 million project that would upgrade a lot of water and sewer mains downtown. One of the big blockages for downtown development has been the age of the infrastructure. It's mostly over 100 years old. It impedes new development. So this project is supposed to help alleviate that concern. We also had a Chinatown bookstore open this week.
Fantastic. We don't have enough bookstores.
Very cool. And Juliana Morano on our team had a really great story about this bookstore and their goals. They came out as a response to the local movement to ban some library books.
Is that the kind of items that they have?
Yeah. So they started initially to sell books that are historically banned in a lot of these places and have evolved into being bigger than that. So they just opened in Chinatown. Juliana's story also talked about how Barnes & Noble is opening a second location at Fashion Fair.
That's wild to me. The publishing industry has been so up and down for so long, but that must be a really good sign if they're opening up a second location. That's
incredible. And it's part of a national move. I think she said
there's
that
a smaller style shop.
Yeah, smaller footprint, but they want to be in places that have lots of foot traffic, and they're opening a lot of stores in places across the U.S., so not just in Fresno. It's an interesting trend.
That's amazing for Fresno and bad for my credit card statements. That's great.
Same. Also in the news, there's been some shenanigans around elections this week, enough that
I heard some people were getting bad mail.
People are getting bad mail. Yes. I've actually gotten a lot of the texts about this that ended up showing up in our story about it. Ultimately, our district attorney, Lisa Smitkamp, and our sheriff, John Zanoni, and our registrar of voters, James Coos, had a press conference to basically say, knock it off. But people are getting letters that have Harris Walls signs in their front yard. And it says, if you don't take your sign out of your yard, we will publish your address on a list and give it to immigrants that are coming from other countries to Fresno and have them set up shop in your house. Hmm.
So this is like a Governor Abbott thing locally.
Correct.
Ship them to your house.
Yeah.
Do we have any sense of who's doing this?
We don't yet.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. You're free to put whatever signs on your front lawn.
Yes.
And it seems unlikely that what these letters are threatening will come to fruition. So I say proceed.
Yes. So not a great story. And then at yesterday's city council meeting, the city attorney's office in the code enforcement division touted a lot of success that they're having in cracking down on illegal selling of marijuana across the city and smoke shops. I have some statistics in the story if you want to see some of the progress that team has made.
Fantastic.
All right, so we have a fun discussion for you all today. It's going to be a meta episode on labor politics and labor unions and labor organizing in the Fresno area. So we have Dylan Savory with us. He's the executive director of the Central Labor Council, which is a coalition of over 50 labor unions in Fresno, Madera, Tulare, and Kings counties. And we have Keith Brewer Brown, who is a climate organizer and reporter at Labor Notes, and recently finished his PhD at UC Berkeley in geography and did a dissertation on the labor movement in Fresno and the Central Valley. So glad to have you both.
Good to be here.
So Dylan, I want to start with you and talk a little bit about your history in labor organizing. And you were the organizer of the Measure G campaign in Fresno. Tell us a little bit about how that got started and how that fits into the arc of the ascent of labor in Fresno.
That's a great question. I get questioned about Measure G all the time, and I think it's because prior to Measure G, no group of organized associations or activists on the left had ever really seen a grassroots effort overturn a government policy. Most of our government, from school board to mayor to county supervisors across our four counties, had been traditionally dominated by conservative Republicans that treated workers not so well. And so we were historically on the defense. We had never really seen an effort or kind of a joint effort between organizations in the grassroots left and organizations with labor, including law enforcement, come together to fight back against government policy. So obviously the recession was happening at the time, and Mayor Swearingen was doing her very best to level set the city and figure out where we could not default on all of our obligations as a city. But labor thought that this was the beginning of a privatization movement that had long been foretold in our area. It was going to be garbage truck workers first, then it was going to be fax bus drivers, then it was going to be any other city department that could outsource. So as that happened, I was really a young organizer at the time, a couple election cycles in, and just learning from some of my predecessors. And we decided that this was going to be a seminal moment and that we were going to put together a campaign to overturn something that we thought had never been done before. There was a number of steps that got us to where we were, but what was great about it was it was going to take thousands and thousands of signatures. And the mayor put this on, I believe, in October for the first vote. And we were able to delay that first vote. And I even think the second vote, because we had three members of the city council that voluntarily did not show up for business during those two meetings and forced there to be no quorum at the city council, which allowed us to go into a long Christmas break and do some organizing. So it was a really, wonderful start to something that gave us some power, felt like we could really do something. We had some elected officials that mattered.
Can you talk a little bit about that organizing in Fresno, which can be a bit more of a conservative community? Like, how do you articulate this? I'm curious from like a communication standpoint.
Yeah, fortunately, the trash division in Fresno was an award-winning division, and that we found out pretty quick that most people identify really well with their public servants, their mail people, their garbage workers, the folks that, that they see in their neighborhoods. As we went out to get signatures, it was actually a really easy message to talk to folks that were Christmas shopping, et cetera, because they all identified this was an award-winning department. We were able to articulate that department actually did not have anything to do with the general fund, which was against the mayor's message, and that most people knew their trash truck driver and thought that they deserved to stay on the job. So
kids love trash truck drivers.
They do.
They're obsessed.
Yeah,
anyway, so you had a really powerful message. You ended up getting the voters to say no to Measure G. What happened after that? How did that sort of help catalyze more local organizing in Fresno?
We had to watch three different counts come in, and mm-hmm. we were behind on all three up until the very end. So we ended up winning that by half a percentage point or something, just a few hundred votes out of, I think, 50,000, if I remember correctly. It's been some time. It's been like 11 years. But everybody came up for air, and it was 2013, so it was right before the next election cycle. And we all started meeting. Labor groups, climate groups, any community groups, Democratic Party groups started meeting together and formed a coalition called the Central Valley Partnership to talk about how we could organize against the power structure, the industry structure in the Central Valley. So that catalyzed kind of what we can accomplish when we work together mentality. And we went on, we weren't winning every election, but it gave us the confidence that we were no longer going to get stomped on all the time. And it fundamentally changed the way that power structures negotiated with labor going forward, the mayor included at the time.
Yeah.
Precedent and roadmap.
Correct.
Yeah.
I was living in Oakland during Measure G, and I remember sitting in a friend's apartment building, watching some of the city council meetings where it was discussed, because I'm that kind of nerd, and just being really fascinated and watching all the energy around the organizing and just being surprised as a person who's from Fresno and hadn't seen that sort of energy before. I, of course, then moved back to Fresno, went to work for Mayor Swearingen for a few years, and then left after that. But it was just, I was really impressed at the early energy around it.
We were too, frankly.
I think everyone was surprised.
Yeah, it was great.
Keith, your dissertation touched quite a bit on how the High Speed Rail Project and the building of a lot of solar farms on the west side has also really reshaped the labor movement in Fresno. And could you talk a little bit about what you saw?
Totally. Yes. Labor unions had been repressed for a long time in the Central Valley. Dylan can tell you a lot of that history too, but there had been a lot of union busting for farm workers, building trades being shut out of construction work in a lot of different parts of the industry. And with high-speed rail coming in, suddenly there was a statewide labor agreement saying there's going to be union labor on these jobs. And suddenly you had hundreds or now even thousands of construction workers getting union jobs that were steady, that were going for months and years on end. And many of those jobs have been in this corridor from Madera down now almost to Bakersfield over the past decade. But it's meant that there's been this real steady kind of work that's helped the unions get enough confidence to grow their membership and say, we're going to have work to come. And that meant that they could bring in a lot of younger members who reflected the community in a different way than the building trades had been able to at some points in the past. So suddenly you get a lot more young Latino members, more women, more formerly incarcerated people. And you see some trades like the iron workers grow 60% in membership in this period, which has been, you know, really impressive and is not happening in most places in the country. And high-speed rail is one piece of that. Solar is another big part of it. Solar power, the big power plants out on the west side of the valley, were not guaranteed to go union. There was nothing in the state law that guaranteed that to happen. It had to be something of a fight where at the state level, as well as at local levels, the unions had to say, we're going to work with the community to make sure that these projects don't get permits unless they're going to make them good jobs. And that model had been worked out fighting natural gas plants and making sure that those jobs would be better a decade before. In the 2010s, unions and community allies helped make sure that basically every big solar power plant has strong union provisions in it. So you've seen this growth where Fresno has been at the heart of both of these kind of booms, the solar boom, the rail boom, and it's the Fresno-based construction unions that have been able to grow and see the most benefit from that.
You talk in your dissertation about how Fresno is different than Bakersfield and why there's been a lot more success here than there has been in Bakersfield. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Part of it is just the geography of where the jobs have been, that the Fresno has been at the heart of where a lot of this work started out. I also think that there's been a concentration of workers in some parts of Fresno and Madera too, who are getting these union jobs, who grew up together, go into the union, help their cousins enter the union. That's helped there be a core in Fresno and to some extent Madera who's witnessed the benefits of this transformation of work and then now want to bring that home and help improve their community and like engage in local politics out of that experience. I think in Bakersfield, it's trickier. The solar jobs are further away from Bakersfield out in the Mojave Desert. And so the workers getting those jobs are more scattered. There isn't this like home base in the same way in the city. And in the city itself, a lot of the building trades members there pick up maintenance jobs in the oil fields or have in the past. And that's some of their better paying work. Historically, even if it's been very unsteady and
depending on the price of oil. And, you know, so there's that political and cultural dynamic, too, where there's this sense that like joining a union is something that you don't talk about. And that's when I grew up there, that was the vibe that I got. And I think that was partly the oil industry, but it's also partly the culture there as well.
But Fresno has that culture, too. I feel like a lot of
Fresno is distinct from Bakersfield in that sense. I would say there's similarities, but the variance is higher than people assume.
That's interesting. Yeah, I grew up in a very anti-union household, and so my early life in Fresno was shaped by very anti-union sentiment, and I think that's really common when I talk to people here. But it's been really fascinating to see how that shifted. And Dylan, going into the election cycle just now, I did a story a few months ago about how much money the labor unions have been putting into local cycles, in some races, outspending developers, business interests. There's been a massive shift and it's really scrambled the political chessboard. So could you talk about what you guys are investing in this cycle, why you're investing, what races are mattering to you?
Yeah, let me like save the back end of that, because what really happened here was prior to 2018, if you got the police endorsement and the chamber's endorsement, they had a consultant or a set of consultants they would always work with. And no matter which level of government, they'd pair it up with Mayor Swearingen or somebody, and they would win every election. And they kept spending their money in the same way. And we started investing in canvassers and ground game and getting students involved. And when we upset them two cycles in a row with major city council races that swung things in our favor.
Which races were those?
So this was Nelson Esparza in 2018 and Tyler Maxwell in 2020. Mm-hmm. And it fundamentally changed the way the city council was going to be operating after that. Those were the two swing districts that we had previously not been able to win. And so the police union went scrambled. They elected new leadership. The person that was running the elections on behalf of those two groups started working somewhere else. And simultaneously, one of the best Republican consultants in town went to work for Mayor Lee Brand. So he was off the board. So like the whole chessboard changed. And then labor started seeing, wow, if we really put money and paid canvassers with our volunteer efforts in, we're going to be able to win a lot more elections. So money started flowing a little more freely after that. And this is right around the time where strikes started happening more, and there's just a bit more of a get on the ground and change things for yourself sentiment. You're talking specifically about the money. The cycle it's hard to track. All of the local outlets are trying to track the money, particularly in the school board races, but things are not moving fast enough. No matter how many good people we get elected, our contracts are not getting that much better, or they're not able to change the administration as fast as we want them to. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's caused a little bit of erratic spending, but it's a little bit of a pendulum. We're trying to figure out what is the most effective. And we have unions spending money on both sides occasionally, which is not always super productive, but we're a federation of democratic associations. Sometimes it happens.
Yeah, why do you spend money on both sides? Help me understand that.
I'd say there's a difference of occasionally we have, it's a union that disagrees maybe that they want to still help somebody who's an incumbent. And
can you give an example of that?
Levine Martinez.
Yeah, the teachers union, rightfully so, believes that not enough was done to try to avert their almost strike this time last year. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the trustees, their response was, hey, you guys got what you want. You wanted ultimately, there was no strike. And meanwhile, the teachers union spent a couple $100,000 organizing their membership, getting ready to take on the system. And it was hardship. It was not easy. Students were nervous. Everybody was nervous. So the teachers union feels like we're coming after everybody because nobody was that helpful. A couple of the trustees may disagree. If you talk to them, they were doing what they thought they could. But the district did a really good job keeping all the trustees running in circles and not working together. And a lot of the times our elected officials cannot impact negotiations once they're underway. They're barred from continue negotiations. So we do have a few examples right now. The teachers union is challenging both incumbents right now, but a few other unions have already been behind those incumbents. And there's a bit of loyalty for some of those unions that feel like maybe these incumbents just need a little bit more time. And the teachers union is rightfully angry that too much time has passed, right? So we end up in these situations occasionally, but I think it's a good exercise.
Yeah. So in the two county supervisor races, District 2 and District 3, you've backed Luis Chavez, Gary Bredefeld. The Gary Bredefeld endorsement has been interesting for a lot of folks because he is a very well-known conservative, quite MAGA, if you will. And he has a lot of labor groups behind him, including SEIU, which a lot of people would not expect. And so why have you guys backed Bredefeld?
The bottom line is that Steve Brandau amounts to about a 0% voter for labor contracts. And at the county, the IHSS contract is about 23,000 of the poorest workers in the county. And they all take care of at least one person, oftentimes a disabled family member. So roundabouts 45,000 people there would be impacted by a raise because they make a quarter above minimum wage. And then there's another 6,000 county workers that are with another SEIU that are not getting a fair shake all the time too. So it's this massive block of people, and Steve's a zero vote. Oftentimes our contracts will pass 3-2. Even after they're negotiated by the administration, two of the conservatives will vote them down, which is just blasphemy.
Just signaling.
Yeah. I think some people surface level would say going with Gary is just a gamble. But we sat down with Gary. We've evaluated how Gary has approached the city contracts as a city council person. And he's been not only receptive, he's been helpful in urging the administration to get fair contracts done. For all of Gary's Twitter rants and the things that you hear him say that are socially not aligned with most of the things that labor is aligned with, he doesn't like corruption. He doesn't like when people don't hold up their word, and he will call out people that are not being, he will stand up for folks when he thinks the issue is incorrect. And the county is full of corruption. The county is a gigantic ball of corruption with low IQ elected officials for most of the Board of Supervisors. And I don't want to call them all out. There's a couple that are really decent. Brian Pacheco is really decent. And Nathan Magzik's pretty decent. But the rest of them need to go. And they're supporting an administration that is not doing enough for workers. So if Gary's going to go in there and be the difference maker, then, and he's got a great relationship with Luis. So why don't we get two people in there that could help us form a coalition that'll change 50,000 lives?
I think people's perception is often filtered through this national lens of extreme differences, but at the local level, it's marginal differences that matter.
Yep.
And so that seems like what you're describing.
Absolutely.
Keith, I'm curious, as a labor scholar, historian, is this something that you're seeing in a lot of places, that national politics don't overlay over local politics quite how you would expect them to be?
A lot of people talk about there being more nationalization of politics than ever before, that these like national debates reach down locally. But I think we're seeing some more breaks with that, with labor finding its voice and being willing to be a little more independent in politics. The most high-profile example is in Nebraska. There's an independent Senate candidate running right now against an incumbent Republican who was a strike leader at Nabisco just last year, Dan Osborne, and is a bit of a mix on the progressive wish list, but is definitely like a vocal advocate of unions and of working people getting organized, and looks like stands a fighting chance. So I think if he wins next week, there's probably going to be a lot more experiments with that out there.
That's interesting. So what's your policy agenda? You talked about the IHSS worker contract. I know that's been a huge issue, and we've reported on that at Fresnoland. I've also heard project labor agreements at the county coming up. Talk about what you want to see in the county on that front.
Wow. If we're going to talk about project labor agreements, we should start with school districts. That's where the majority of the work's going to come in. Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, the county,
if the bonds pass.
There's already bonds in place for most of the districts, right? If they're district-wide project labor agreements, they're going to cover things in the perpetuity or for a 10-year period. And a lot of our project labor agreements in place now are really for general contractors and for just a few of our trade locals. The county fixing those contracts is number one. It's such a massive impact. I think a countywide PLA is something that is probably further down the road, I have to say.
Could you explain what a PLA is for people who don't know?
A project labor agreement is sometimes a one project collective bargaining agreement that defines the terms of the agreement with the end user and the local unions. But it also allows non-union contractors to bid on that work and play by the rules that the union plays by. So there's probably 15 ways to describe this that are maybe more complete than I'll be able to offer, but it's a master agreement that defines the terms of work. It prevents work stoppages. It makes sure that the types of work are defined for each local so there's no fighting, and allows projects to be done on time and under budget, which is what they've almost always proved to be. And
the airport expansion is under a PLA for
the airport expansion. Yeah. Almost all of this
work basically now. Yeah, that's a big deal here, because Fresno was the first city in the country to ban this kind of project labor agreement in 2002. And so for less than 20 years later, to have a council that was willing to say, we're going to make all work in the city have this kind of project labor agreement because it does better work and it provides a much better living and power to working people, is a big deal and a real accomplishment of the labor movement here.
Yeah.
I remember when the first PLA got signed in Fresno, what was that, 2017? Around
high speed rail search.
Transformative climate communities, and not really understanding what that meant, but just, oh, this sounds interesting. Okay. No idea what that would become. It's been fascinating to watch.
And there's a lot of cool things. I mean, you're seeing with the airport PLA, there's some of the poorest zip codes can source workers into the apprenticeship, direct entry into the apprenticeship, and allow for us to diversify, you know, the workforce as much as possible. Every union right now, every trade local has a line out the door that it's going to take them years to get in unless the work really speeds up, which we think it will. But
can we just pause on that for a sec? Because I see a lot of questions out in the ether around how do people get into that pipeline? What is the best way for people to get into that pipeline?
So for the most unions to get in, you have to get hired by an employer that's represented. But for trade locals, you would go straight to the local hall, and there's around 12 of them in the area, and then you sign up with them and get certified, et cetera. There's a number of different, you have to have math requirements for electricians, et cetera, high school diploma. There's a number of pre-qualifications, but so many people want the benefits of being in a construction local. The difference between, you know, a non-represented carpenter and a represented carpenter is probably $45 an hour. And it's a massive jump. It's a huge benefit. But they can't bring in people for the sake of bringing in people if there's not work there. Mm-hmm. You don't want to bring them into a five-year apprenticeship and then have them sit there and not be able to work. Because once you're in, mm-hmm. you can't go off and just trail off and work in the non-union sector. You need to stay in. So it's difficult, but they need to go straight to the union. You can look almost all of them up. Carpenters Union Fresno, for instance, plumbers and pipe fitters, electricians, iron workers. And most of them are all publicly listed. It's just the demand is so high that these project labor agreements allow for us to do very specific things around veterans or minority-owned folks. You know, there's a lot of different ways, direct entry, that project labor agreements can spell out that are also community benefits.
Would you say that pre-apprenticeships have also been a good path for people in here?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Cool. I mean, they have to start somewhere, yeah. right? And it gives each union the opportunity to almost screen and find people from a defined pool rather than sometimes people walk in and say, oh, I've been doing electricity for 14 yeah. years. And you go, okay, well, go out and prove it. And if you can't, they're going to send you back. And there's not always the easiest way to scout people.
Yeah. On this podcast, we've had a number of discussions recently around affordable housing, building, some of the homelessness ordinances, and then just development in general. And something we hear a lot, you know, particularly with the high-speed rail, given how sclerotic it is and all the challenges. I have a friend who's an engineer, and he's, I think, been working on the same 20 feet for the last 9 months, something to that effect. But essentially, there, a common criticism or something that we hear, and we're hearing it at both national levels and the Republican and Democratic Party, is how do we accelerate development? How do we build? And one of the things that we hear a lot, at least I hear a lot, is that unions make things more expensive to build. They add layers of complication and regulation into projects. How would each of you respond to that, maybe generally, and then with some specific examples here locally?
I think unions could be, and in many cases are, the most powerful engine of advocating for new public investment that can really speed up affordable housing development. The private sector is not building affordable housing almost anywhere of its own accord. It will in small bits when it is forced to by public law. If we want the kind of affordable housing we need, then the places that are inching towards that have done so because they've built a coalition with labor where labor sees it as this is going to help build a lot of good union jobs. This is going to help us grow these unions with a lot of new community members. And then that becomes a kind of political backing that can see development through to the very end. The private sector will try and cut every corner it can to build luxury housing or housing that isn't addressing the affordable housing problem. And the only way out of that sort of race to the bottom model of housing that has worked historically in this country to address affordable housing is public investment in whether it's cooperatively, nonprofit owned, publicly owned, or subsidizing private developers in some cases to do it. That's the path to fix the problem and fill the hole. And you got to have unions on board if that path has any viability.
It's a wonderful point. And, you know, it's a little bit of just a funny saying, but the truth of it is you do not want your workers working on the affordable housing development to be ultimately living in that affordable housing development, right? You want to use public dollars because that's generally where these projects get funded from. Occasionally, union pension funds will leverage funds to do affordable housing, et cetera. But you don't want to build, you want your taxpayers to be used in the best possible way that stays within your community and has a multiplier effect. And so if you're paying people under the table or without benefits, or if they're on public assistance, you're really not solving the problem at all.
Yeah, we brought this up with, what's it called again? I always forget that name. The Southeastern.
Oh, SEDA.
Yeah, with SEDA, there's been a lot of discussions around labor and
Yeah.
The Southeast Development
Area.
Yeah. Yeah. Why is labor getting involved in suburban development? It's fascinating.
Well, if anybody's read Greg's articles on Fresno Land, he has spelled it out perfectly, thanks to a lot of conversations with all of us. The private developers that build housing in this community are not only politically misaligned and much too powerful, but I mean, they have a terrible model of sprawl that eats away at the inner city and all the core services that we require. And then they demand and use political favors to get $1 billion or more of public infrastructure built out to a community. And then they build those houses with the cheapest labor they can find. And hopefully I'm not offending anybody here, but if you live way out in one of those new communities, the walls are, everything's built cheap there. And it's a bit of white flight. Fresno's probably the worst planned city in America. Has anybody been to a worse planned city?
Was it planned?
Thank you. That's probably a great point. It's been white flight up until now, say that, right?
As everybody a former knows. Fresno city planner, yes. I will say that there are forces beyond city planners that make the bad planning.
Exactly, that's the issue. Yeah.
And SATA's one of them, yes. Right?
Track homes are done shoddily. You talk to someone in commercial development and they'll laugh about track homes. And I live in a track home and I see how fast it was put together, but it's housing. And so there is a housing crisis. So it, in some respects, it could be improved. But I think the intent of it is, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm defending
there's this tension of
it's housing at a scale that
if they were all union contracts, could we deliver at that scale?
Yeah, and we've discussed about the challenges of infill, and their people will build out there.
So do we have an affordability crisis or a housing crisis? There is plenty of space in the city to build. There's just not. I think there's some interesting things happening along Blackstone right now that could really be a model for how we're doing infill. We're going to have to bring developers in from outside the area that are more skilled in this and can see projects through. But the current crop of kind of developers that we have, they are not. The real problem for us is you're going to spend $1 billion and all the city's resources leveraging trying to get sewers and water built out there. It's a Ponzi scheme. You have to pay for the city, all the city services into perpetuity, and the fees never pay you back enough. That's why we don't have any parks here. That's why our city budget's always upside down. And why aren't we building downtown? Like the mayor just announced, we got $22 million out of 50 plus more coming from the state. If we're going to put that much money into a SATA development, why wouldn't we be spending that downtown? Because property taxes, the more you go up, it's a multiplier effect to me. When unions are involved, we're working on the more complicated projects. And if we're redoing a high-rise building or we're breaking open streets, that's where like all of the unions and trades are involved and you're getting the most out of your money. But we're just going to spend $1 billion and then the private sector is going to go hire probably the lowest wage workers with no benefits, and then we're never going to get any return on that investment.
Speaking of policy agendas, Labor was quite involved in Measure C, which failed in 22. What do you want out of that process?
Unfortunately, we had groups on both sides, and I unsuccessfully tried to bring two sides together, and then I haven't been involved in the more recent unsuccessful attempts. I think the labor partners that fought that were really interested in getting labor standards similar to Project Labor Agreement involved, and the business community, where their response was, this is going to fail if we put labor standards in it, which is ridiculous. It's already prevailing wage work. Almost every politician everywhere, when you talk about PLAs, they really like what it's going to do for their community. Without having labor standards and
when you say labor standards, what do you mean?
Something that's going to guarantee that work goes to fairly compensated and highly trained workers, a skilled workforce. And that really, it's not always union. I don't want to say that there's not skilled people working outside of unions, but when you have billions of dollars at play and really important projects, we want to make sure that unions are most likely going to be the workforce that is deployed to those jobs. And we want to bring more people into the unions. It's not, we want to keep billions of dollars just for our group of people. No, we want to expand every trade by 10 and have thousands and thousands of high paying living wage jobs here in the Valley. So it was a bit of an either or. Unfortunately, a couple of the groups that decided to come in and fight Measure C at the end did it a little too late to convince the rest of the group that while they had a just reason, a few of the groups were already bought in financially, or had already been working on it. And a couple of the groups that a couple of the unions that were going to gain the most amount of work, they were already in from the beginning. So it created a bit of division.
What types of unions benefit most from road construction projects?
Yeah, so the laborers union, they're going to do a variety of things, but they have shovels in their hands, right? They're doing stuff on the side of the streets. They're holding the stop signs, cones, all of the safety kind of provisions, and the operating engineers, which do all the heavy machinery. Mm-hmm. Those are going to be most of them. The carpenters have some of that work too. The carpenters have 13 crafts under their banner, so they have a lot of different things, but you weren't going to see a ton of electricians or sheet metal or iron workers out there. It was going to be mostly new road development and repaving, and that's mostly laborers and operators.
Got it.
And so they've been monitoring this and were happy with a renewal because they get a lot of this work. I mean, by default, it's prevailing wage. They have most of the contractors. It's, public sector work. But a couple of the other unions thought, if the county's going to keep, not giving us what we wanted every other sector or every other opportunity, we're going to fight this and make sure that we're a force to be reckoned with. So it's a little bit of a flex. And now we're wondering if the two sides can put it back together. It's they're playing chicken right now.
Yes, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Starbucks. So last year we had a failed unionizing attempt at Starbucks. Our Amazon warehouse workers in Fresno are also not unionized. Why are we not seeing as much momentum in the private sector around unionizing
efforts? Yeah, and are there certain industries where it's hard? Something like Starbucks, where we've had a number of coffee shops around here attempt to organize and encounter a number of challenges. So are there certain industries where it's more challenging for specific reasons?
The higher the turnover, the tougher it is. And a coffee shop is real high turnover, people who don't plan to be there forever. Plus, in the case of Starbucks and Amazon, you've got employers who have made it clear they're dead set on keeping out the union. And they may beat them anyway. I think there are some really promising signs with organizing picking up at Amazon nationally, with the Teamsters supporting efforts in a ton of cities right now that are moving towards elections. And Starbucks is sitting down for bargaining nationally, which the company said was impossible most recently as a year ago. There's some promising momentum, but this isn't the whole private sector, but there are these really big companies that have an almost ideological commitment to keep out unions, to prove something to themselves, maybe.
What about independent local shops? That's obviously a different kind of challenge. You're not bargaining with some mega conglomerate far away. It's a local entrepreneur.
I've seen more success there overall, but there's still a real mix that happens out there. Yeah, Dylan, what would you say have been highlights of small shop organizing here?
Man, I'm not sure I could point to one. Yeah. The cannabis industry really is where it's at, but it's coming from UFCW, who's doing this statewide and is able to, and several of the cannabis shops here exist in other parts of the state and have seen the relationship work. So I haven't, I think the Fulton Street Coffee was the one that you might be referring to. And we weren't really even, sometimes really young progressive people, they know about all these national things and they have no connection to their neighbors or what's happening. So we didn't get flagged to this at all. And I'm a little unclear. I don't want to speak out of turn on that particular instance, but sometimes young people just start going at it and they realize that the NLRA is not a really good law for organizing. Labor's been trying to fix the NLRA for years and years, and Democrats always place something in front of that, like Obamacare, which is wonderful, but we had an opportunity to fix labor law in this country and it always gets set aside. So we want to make it easier to organize. But to your point, why is it not happening here? Most of our unions have their headquarters elsewhere in California, Northern California, Sacramento, San Jose, the Bay Area, and they are dedicating long-term organizers and resources to the lowest hanging fruit, which is where it is in their part of the, so the labor council
friendly environments.
Trying to build up our credibility here and tell some of our unions, you need to put more resources here. ACE is a good one in Clovis, right? Mm-hmm. They're on a long term, they're going to get that. It's probably happening slower than they wanted it to. But private sector-wise, I think cannabis is the one we can point to the easiest, but it really goes back to relationships that they already had.
So we normally end these podcasts by sharing what we're loving this week, but since this podcast will publish the day of a national election, we thought we'd share some of our most memorable election night experiences. Donnie, when you think about memorable election nights, what comes to mind?
I think if you're a millennial, you're thinking about 2008.
Yep.
And I was in Ithaca, New York, where I was in grad school and at a bar and drinking beers with my friends, and the election results got called for Obama and there was a huge, massive party in the street and you just had to be there. It was great.
Yeah. I was also, I think, at a bar in San Francisco watching the results come in, and it just felt different. But I think probably more memorable for me was 2016. I was in a class and the professor refused to put it on the screen, the results, until they had come in. And so it was 9 o'clock at night. I think it was a night class. He put it on the screen and there was just a dramatic gasp. This was in Los Angeles. So that's the politics that were in the room. And people were shocked.
I was thinking 2008 too. I was volunteering for the Obama campaign in Vegas, and yeah, it was, you already took that. But in some ways, that felt like a big win, but turned out to not feel as transformative a few years later as I think we, most of us hoped. So what the one I'm reflecting on now is 2020, the primary night, where I had been really active in organizing with the Bernie campaign in Oakland. And that night was both the end, effectively, of Bernie's primary run, but also seeing the results come in. I saw that he swept, you know, the vast majority of counties in California, especially like working class and Latino majority, Fresno County, all throughout the valley, all throughout the Inland Empire, working class, Latino majority districts. I'm like, this is different than 2016, the coalition he had. And you saw that all over the country that night. So there was a Newsweek reporter at the election night party that I had helped organize in, for the campaign in Oakland. And they're like, man, you must be feeling bummed. I'm like, the future was shown to us tonight, that there's this huge coalition for working class, progressive, even socialist politics out there. And it's been harder to keep that going than it felt was possible in that moment. But I think that potential is still out there. We're just 4 years out from that. And I think building the power of labor in politics is the clearest path I can see to make that future happen.
A great point. I'm glad you brought up Bernie. I have a funny story I'll try to wrap up, because it's a little bit of a dig at some of the boomer Hillary ladies in town, and they're probably not listening to this.
Are
anyway.
They organized, those boomer Hillary ladies?
I'm not sure they listen to podcasts.
A little bit. Yeah. I'm not sure.
This is 2016, diehard Bernie, and this is the general election, and the Democratic Women's Club was just abusive to young people that were Bernie's never going to win. It was really anti-millennial in a lot of ways, anti-labor in some ways as well, and obnoxious about Hillary. So things that a lot of us saw, I think, in retrospect. And so at the time, the Democratic Women's Club was going to host an election night watch party at UFCW8, which is the office I worked in. But our watch party was going to be with Henry Perea Sr., who was running for mayor in the town. And I was pretty much doing the entire Labor Council's political program on my own. So I go home, I scoop up my wife, I clean up, and go up to the watch party. When I get in the room, it's clear that Henry had lost right out the gate. And we had pretty much based our entire campaign around that. And it was clear that Trump was going to win. So everybody was in a terrible mood. And here I am ordering drinks and shots for people and eating, because I'm just happy to be like dissolved of my stress. And I'm not really putting into context what had happened. And I happened to turn 30. I was like, so I was a little bit like, okay, how am I going to feel? The next day I go to work just trying to clean up. And I opened the shared fridge at our office, and there was a congratulations, Madam President cake with one slice taken out of it. The rest of the cake was still there.
What a metaphor.
And I couldn't help but laugh a little bit. Like, I fucking told you guys that Bernie was going to win. Bernie should have been the candidate. But it was funny, but not funny. So I spent my 30th birthday just like for the next week, just like, what happened here?
That
so,
was your birthday cake.
I didn't want to touch it either. But anyway, it was Bernie losing local elections and then coming full circle to where we're at now.
With that sad cake, we'll conclude today's episode. Thank you so much, Keith.
Yeah,
and
thank
Dylan.
You both.
This is great.
Thanks all.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.